It's the Right to Die edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, killer hypnotist, Zamboni funding, listener email, and the right to die. Let's start episode 122.
Through early morning fog I see visions of the things to be, the pains that are withheld for me. I realize and I can see that suicide is painless. It brings on many changes, and I can take or leave it if I please. The game of life is hard to play. I'm gonna lose it anyway. The losing card I'll someday lay. So this is all I have to say.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
Back with the guys is Jenna, your microbiologist biochemist.
You know, I never knew that the MASH song had theme song, had lyrics.
Had lyrics, yes. Yeah. And like I say, so what's the name of the MASH theme song?
It is suicide is painless. Again, I just thought it was the MASH song.
Well, actually, typically it's often referred to, and I think technically it's referred to as the MASH theme, brackets, suicide is painless. So it's one of those, which came first, the chicken or the egg sort of thing. I thought an interesting anecdote about it when I was doing research into the song, why I would do that, I don't know, but was that the person who did the lyrics for the song is actually the son of the director of the movie. I think it's the director of the movie. And he was commenting that he got paid like $70,000 to direct the movie. But his son has made like hundreds, if not millions, of dollars off of the rights to the song, and he's somewhat, well, not annoyed at it, but it's bizarre how it works out.
Well, didn't Robert Altman direct the movie?
I'm not sure.
I think he did pretty well for himself, actually.
But not from that movie.
Not from that movie, but in his many, his long career. But speaking of
bizarre things, I was reading a report from ABC News about hypnotism being blamed for the death of some young high school students. Here's the story that, as I read it, quote, three Florida high school students are dead after being hypnotized by their school principal in Sarasota County, one in a car accident and two by suicide. Principal George, I'll leave his last name out because I don't think he's really guilty, is believed to have hypnotized up to 75 people, including students, members of the school staff, and their children. Sarasota County School District officials repeatedly warned him to stop the practice, which the principal insisted was only done in the interests of helping students to be motivated and focused on their schoolwork. Now, one of the deaths was a car accident, and the other was a drug overdose, likely also accidental. So I thought this was kind of weird scapegoating. We talked about scapegoating before. Mm-hmm. I also did a little look into hypnotism. The commonly held belief is that hypnotism places someone into a trance, and when they're in that trance, they're sort of under the absolute control of whoever's hypnotizing them. However, of course, you know, this is not actually sort of how it works. Famous magician, debunker, and founder of JREF, James Randi, defined hypnotism as a mutual agreement of the operator and the subject that the subject will cooperate in following suggestions. So essentially, they both kind of know that there's something going on when you see the public demonstrations of, you know, you think you're chicken and you start bark, bark, bark. However, of course, there is actually sort of a real form of hypnotism, and these are simply people who achieve sort of a deep level of relaxation, where it is claimed they can have, you know, a certain greater sense of self and calm and centering and all that. But there is no sort of, you know, I am under your power. The best you get is in a relaxed state. You can have a better sense of talk therapy with a counselor or something like that. So again, you know, when this sort of came up, I just thought, wow, you know, people taking their poor views of something and accusing this principal of killing. And of course, if he is a killer hypnotist, 3 out of 75 isn't really a great ratio if he was intending to kill them all.
And just a tidbit, I happen to know that James Randi hates it when people call him a debunker. His point of view is that he goes in to investigate, and occasionally he debunks, but he never goes in intending to debunk things. But I do remember a couple months ago, the event series New Bright Lights hosted a talk, and our former co-host Rob gave a talk on magic and skepticism. One of the fellow presenters was a hypnotist who also specialized in homeopathy, which is like a double whammy. And this guy, Rob Hadley, tried to hypnotize these people on stage, and he had this woman sitting in a chair, and he was like, okay, you're getting very sleepy, so sleepy you're going to fall out of your chair. And she's just sitting there, and he's like, so sleepy you'll fall out of your chair. And he's like shaking her shoulder, and she's like, no. And it was just an epic fail. So hypnotists, I think it's all about acting, and I doubt this guy has done anything to actually kill somebody.
No.
Well, it seems like a bit of a witch hunt, you know. These deaths that are obviously really tragic for the community and seems a bit of a cluster, most likely, as you were saying, unrelated. You can't, I mean, with those kind of emotions running around, you can't help but look for a scapegoat and look for some kind of cause. You know, hypnotism seems like sort of an interesting one, especially since, you know, hypnotists have been patronized by high school graduation since time immemorial, so I guess we can know what's not happening in Florida this year.
Yeah. Well, you know, and the funny thing that's just struck me is, like, in trying to do research into this just struck me as one of those, someone said something, you know, at the radio station or TV station, said, hey, I hear three kids died, and did you know Fred does hypnotism? And they go, wait, that'd be a great story. They typed it up. And that's as far as it ever went. Because I tried to find more on this, right, as to, you know, was there some particular issue with this guy? Was there religious overtones? Because it's the States, you know, those sort of things. But there's very, very little information other than the, hey, hypnotists are bad and they're out to kill your children.
On the other hand, he does seem like a bit of a dedicated educator to try and be innovating new techniques to actually make his students, like, whether it works or not, to trying to be coming up with new or at least very unconventional methods to increase the focus of his students.
Yeah. I mean, the question is, if he honestly believes hypnosis has a certain power, and the students honestly believe it has a certain power, they can give it a certain power and play along with it to, you know, serious consequences. I mean, I don't know. Was there some kind of link to them dying? Like, did he hypnotize them that they were going to do a drug overdose or something?
Yeah,
like,
no. Again, because, I mean, the inkling you get from this was he was using it more as a therapeutic thing, not the stage thing, as to get people in a relaxed state and then sort of use a version of talk therapy to sort of, you know, try and, you know, either boost one's confidence for the upcoming game, or if you're having difficulties, you know, just get relaxed and let's try and focus on things. It seemed relatively innocent enough. Mm-hmm. But again, the big thing is there's such an absence of evidence, and yet this news story made it big in a lot of, at least the American circuit.
Well, that's interesting. Why don't we go on to some listener emails that we get here on Radio Free Thinker. Our first email comes from Kathy, and she writes, hey, Radio Free Thinker, I love your show. I've been listening to it for a few months now as a podcast. Thank you, Kathy. We appreciate that. And she writes that I'd love to hear something about biomeridian stress testing. I know some people are very excited about this test and suggest it to everyone. They found someone performing this, quote, diagnostic in the back of a health food store and started talking about their claims related to allergies and parasites, etc. Well, thanks for the email, Kathy, and I looked up biomeridian stress testing, and from what I've been able to gather, it's some kind of alternative medicine for allergies. It sometimes goes by the name biomeridian stress testing or biomeridian treatments or meridian treatments. They all seem to be used that term interchangeably. And it involves using some kind of no-touch acupuncture to cure allergies by strengthening organs or preventing allergic reactions. Now, how does it supposedly work? I'm not too sure about that. The websites that I could find for companies that were offering this service were extremely vague about what exactly the process involves, which is obviously a huge red flag. If a company had a treatment that worked and was effective, they'd be very clear on what the process is, how it works, and what it does. So I got a quote from one of the websites that I was looking at. Our medical office has used sublingual provocative neutralization techniques for treating patients with adverse reactions to inhalants, foods, and chemicals. That just sounds kind of jargony. They continue. This technique is described in detail elsewhere and has been proven, in quotation marks, on their website, it was in quotation marks, beyond any reasonable doubt by numerous double-blind studies executed by various investigators in multiple centers and reported in a number of peer-reviewed medical journals.
If there's anything I know about scientists, they love to give specific citations because you get to see your name.
Yes.
So I'm not quite sure where the, you know, peer-reviewed journals,
Did they have links to them?
Little name.
No, it was, in fact, it was a big block of text, and I had to sort of read through it all to find this one reference to these sources. But I did a bit more digging, and biomarketing testing seems to involve using electronic devices to measure some sort of vaguely described form of energy that apparently indicates when somebody is ill or not.
I'd just like to interject at this point that I think it's, you know, the comment that you made before about what the technique actually was based on their website, use the word sublingual, which means under your tongue. So I'm not 100% sure what the heck they think is going on with their own procedure.
Yeah, it's a good question. Another website that I looked at made it sound more like acupuncture, but with tapping instead of needles, what they called energy meridian tapping, or EMT, which is apparently a, quote, user-friendly version of the long-established meridian tapping modality called TFT, thought field therapy, which just sounds woo-woo. So if I understand it correctly, this is some form of acupuncture that relies on a theory called radionics, which is an idea that illness and health can be detected by energy emissions from the body, and that theory was created by Dr. Albert Abrams in the early 1920s, and it's basically been around in some form ever since. When all tests fail to either find that energy or indicate the illness, or show that the device that is supposed to detect these illnesses doesn't work, proponents often say that there's some kind of like spiritual or paranormal element that's integral to using the device that the investigator simply doesn't have. So it sounds pretty wacky. I did a little looking around because Kathy mentioned the potential dangers of such a treatment, and I was able to dig up a few alarming reports related to biomeridian testing. One was about a naturopath who was taking this treatment to Haiti after the earthquake to help people, basically performing this biomeridian tapping on people to help treat their earthquake-related injuries. Now, I guess maybe he has good intentions. Unfortunately, this sort of treatment is scientifically implausible, and it could delay or prevent necessary medical treatment. Additionally, I heard about a naturopath, Johnny Curran, who's in Rhode Island, and his office was raided by the FDA and the IRS because he was practicing medicine without a license. And one of the treatments that he did offer was biomeridian stress assessment. So I think when you take a look at some of the, well, lack of evidence, it generally looks like this is some kind of woo treatment, probably popular amongst the alternative medicine crowd. I don't think I've seen this locally, but it wouldn't surprise me because there's so much of it out there anyway.
I know when I was living in Prince George, I had friends who were sort of into this sort of healing thing, which one of the things that this light plays upon is, one, the human body, I mean, our nervous system does have a certain amount of bioelectric energy, but more importantly is the galvanic response is that, you know, our skins are conductive to energy, and if you have a black box, and when I was doing my research, I thought it was interesting, quite often they would refer to it officially as the black box,
right?
You would have, you know, some form of conductor with a small electric current going through and little needles, and you'd see the needles adjust and they'd look at the numbers, and that would help distinguish, you know, whether you had cancer or whether you were suffering from this or from the other. Other people would, you know, say, well, not only can it diagnose, but if you put a little bit more into it, you can actually realign these energies. The biofeedback ones that I was looking at actually pointed out that they would take acupuncture, the needles, which are attached to wires, and they would actually use sort of a combination of both the acupuncture and the electric sort of system. And again, you'd get these little fluctuations in the needles and say, aha, there, you see, you can see that it's working, when really these are just sort of natural occurring things that would happen. In the same sort of sense, when you have dowsers who sit there and they have the little wires and the wires cross, and you have the ideomotor effect, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it looks like something's happening, but it's just part of the natural weirdness of the human body.
Well, yeah, if you feed a current through a human, it's going to come out the other end, right? I mean, we do conduct electricity.
Right. But we don't conduct it solidly. Yeah. And that's the important, that's why you get these fluctuations, right? That it does look like something is moving in there.
Well, and much of our body works on electrical impulses. All of our muscle contractions, all of our neurological transmissions are all electrical impulses, and they do have a specific frequency that can vary with different body states. So for example, predatory fish in the ocean are really good at sensing these electrical impulses and interpreting the frequencies to mean different states of their prey fish. People aren't fantastic at doing this. So again, it feels like something that is based at the very, very basic level of something that actually is plausible, but not something that we're at a state in our technology right now that we're able to either detect or interpret.
Well, it's like the lie detector test, right? I mean, you are measuring real things in there, but one, you know, again, as you say, our interpretation of that is so poor, and two, the equipment we're using is so poor at it too, right? I mean, these are not exactly high-tech pieces of equipment, and they're trying to measure what potentially are incredibly subtle things in our biochemistry, which again has absolutely nothing to do with the kind of diagnosing or treatment that they're trying to do. I was reading it, and it struck me as absolutely hilarious that the Dr. Abrams, I think he's a doctor, he might not have been, who sort of originally started a lot of this modern version would sit there and would take a patient and thump on his stomach and feel the vibration. And then he would get someone to take a card with a cancer cell, put it to the guy's forehead for a few minutes, and then thump again and see the variations in the vibrations, and that's how he would do some of his diagnosis. And I'm going, what the hell are you talking about? But
it's pretty wacky when you kind of go into the sort of the origin of some of these woo-woo things. Well, let's do another email, this one from Janice. And Janice writes, listening to episode 121, the discussion about baby swinging yoga and the inherent dangers, I agree the greatest threat comes from the ill-informed. And I'm going to trim a bit because Janice wrote quite a lot here, but we'll post it on the show notes. She mentions gymnastics as another example of permanent long-term injury to young bones when children play the sport. She also mentions the harm that a chiropractor can employ. So she writes, all possibly safe if administered by a knowledgeable person, but is the risk acceptable? Should the risk be tolerated? I guess the point that I'm trying to make is, not everybody can swing a baby. Does that mean no one can? Well, again, thanks for the email, Janice. And I think perhaps the root of this issue here is risk-benefit analysis, which I believe we kind of mentioned last week as well. When engaging in any activity, one must weigh the risk with the potential benefits. And as skeptics, we must also weigh the claims with the evidence available. Can swinging a baby benefit in any way? Given the current scientific knowledge about how infants develop mentally and physically, I would suggest no, that there's little evidence that they'll remember the experience and little evidence that they will gain any spatial awareness from it. So I would suggest that the risks, small as they might be, outweigh the gains. But something like gymnastics, for instance, well, there is an understood benefit. You get stronger, you get better balance, you gain a new skill set, you probably gain more confidence and that sort of thing as well. And the risk is you could break your neck. But it's also important to remember that they don't start you off with the dangerous stuff. They sort of teach you as you go, and there's a learning curve involved. And likewise, with sort of any activity that you engage in, generally you don't start in the deep end. You kind of work your way slowly along. It's sort of like karate or something. You know, you don't start fighting off Bruce Lee. You start, you know.
What you do in your mind.
In your mind.
Trust me,
yeah.
When I was young, I was Bruce Lee. That's who I was after.
Yeah. I don't even finish off fighting Bruce Lee.
Yeah. Yeah, I think with most kids, it's probably like, they learn how to do that hi-ya thing or something. But yeah, it's for sports and that sort of thing, I think it's more of a learning curve. And when we're talking about sort of potentially experimental treatment, you have to do the sort of same thing. You have to measure the risks and the benefits. And you have to say, okay, well, is the risk that I'm going to, you know, throw my baby into a wall, is that worth, you know, teaching them how to, you know, enjoy spatial awareness. And likewise with other things like chiropractic, for instance, it has dubious evidence behind it. And we, have been, we have seen demonstrated effects of people getting strokes and having serious problems from chiropractic experiences.
I think one of the big things that this baby swinging yoga sort of brought out was two things. One is how young is too young? I mean, gymnastics, right? If you have a 5-month-old and you're trying to get them to do the balance beam, again, I'm not sure how you would, but you know, I think, again, you know, sure, gymnastics are good for kids, but there's a certain age where it's not, it's too young. And two, the big thing that they were trying to make a claim for with the baby swing yoga was sort of to feel free in floating in three dimensions. And in a certain degree, you could kind of do that by having it paradoxically strapped in to like a car seat or a bubble cage, so that if it did swing out of your hands, you know, the child itself would suffer no injury, even though it would get the G-force acceleration and the 360 sort of, you know, I mean, like there are other ways you could sort of implant this sort of I'm free floating without the risk of slippery fingers throwing the kid into the wall.
I think one of the other issues that this brings up is that both the benefit and the risk occur on a spectrum. And you again get that question of where the heck do you draw the line in both those things and who gets to make those decisions? I think the other thing that, you know, we start to think of when we look at sports versus the swinging yoga is, does have to do with age, but it's more informed consent. You know, that child is going to physically climb on the balance beam, but a 5-year-old does not have a choice of whether or not it swung from its ankles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the thing with sports as well is, at a young age, I mean, even something like hockey, for instance, I played hockey when I was a kid, and they're quite adamant that this is going to be, like, for fun. And the kids are going to skate around and chase the puck around, but there's going to be no hitting. And even the coaches, they don't teach you really how to play hockey. They sort of teach you how to stay on your feet. And likewise, I suspect with most sports that they tailor their teaching to the age group. And then when you
if you're a good coach.
Yeah, if you're a good coach. I'm sure there's probably bounds of bad ones. But I imagine that when you get a bit older, you know, maybe you're around 12 or 13 or whatever, then they start teaching you the more dangerous things. And that's where you have to take a serious decision about whether or not you want to proceed with something like that. But speaking of actually risk-benefit analysis, Jenna, after the commercial break, you're going to tell us about a controversial medical treatment that's getting funding.
I am.
All right, well, stay tuned for that here on Radio Freethinker.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts downtown at 212 Productions, Beat Street Records, Blim, Dream Apparel, The Fall Tattooing, Heart and Soul Clothing Incorporated, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinema Tech, Scratch Records, True Value Vintage, Vinyl Records, and Zoo Shop.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the Sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So, Jenna, this new controversial medical treatment, is it safe?
Well, we're about to find out. So I know that on the show before, the guys here have discussed the Zamboni treatment, also known as the Liberation treatment, which is a controversial treatment that has been proposed for multiple sclerosis. So I'm bringing it up again because we have a new development. Basically, the federal government has announced that it's going to open up funding for clinical trials of the Zamboni procedure. So just to orient everyone in the conversation here, this is an operation that involves either angioplasty or stents in the neck veins, and this is to help treat multiple sclerosis because, you know, based on this procedure, it's ostensibly caused by chronic cerebrospinal venous insufficiency. So this is basically a malformation or narrowing of the veins in your neck such that your the blood is not able to drain from your brain very easily. So this is a really emotional topic for sufferers of MS, as it's basically the one of the very first things that's really provided a promise or at least a hope of relief from this really devastating disease. For those who don't know, MS causes a degeneration of the nerves in the brain and the spinal cord nerves. Basically, you're losing function in various capacities, and it ends up being chronically debilitating and fatal. So the major reason that this operation has been very controversial is that there's not actually a scientific consensus that this cerebrospinal venous insufficiency, or CCSVI, is a causative element of multiple sclerosis. So there hasn't been a cause and effect relationship established. So basically the procedure is very invasive. So it involves either angioplasty, and this is where you stick a little uninflated balloon on a guide wire up into the vein, and then inflate the balloon such that it opens the vein, basically presses it open and moves the fat deposits such that when you deflate the balloon, it stays open further, and then you withdraw the balloon. Or alternatively, you can use a stent, which is an actual implant of a mesh device that fits into the vein and holds it in an open position. So in either case, this is a very, very invasive procedure and involves getting inside the veins. And clearly, it's not a procedure to be taken lightly. However, as we were talking about earlier, it really has been a major push from the MS suffering community because of the hope that its inventor, Dr. Samboni, was purporting to actually be the result of this procedure. So it's been really worrisome, as it is based on the assumption that MS is caused by CCSVI, which I will continue to call it because it's shorter. However, the connection between this condition of the veins and the degeneration in MS has not actually been demonstrated to the satisfaction of the greater medical research community. But this doesn't mean that this group of researchers, and by group of researchers, I mean all of them interested in this area, have just been ignoring this procedure and shrugging it off, because that's not really what scientists do, no matter what the media might tell you. They've been investigating properly the connection between the narrowing of the veins and MS. And recently, there have been several key studies that the results have come through, and it actually does look plausible that these two conditions might be connected. And that is why the Canadian government has decided to open up funding to go ahead with clinical trials to see whether or not this procedure can remediate the degeneration of MS. So what I'd like to stress here is the process, because the government has really been demonized by a lot of people dealing with MS because it hasn't acted sooner. But what needs to be understood in this type of situation is that good research takes time, and you can't just cut the corners or you end up with really safe, unsafe procedures. And so we need to maintain this level of safety and effectiveness that people are expecting in their medical care. So in keeping with this sort of regulation and proper procedure, the funding isn't just being opened up. It's not really open season on the Zamboni procedure. But the funding will be administered by CIHR, which is the Canadian Institute for Health Research. So this is the government body that basically doles out research grants for any sort of research happening in the health sciences field by the government. And this is a peer review process, which I discussed a little bit in a blog I wrote up a couple of weeks ago. And so the CIHRs are given to researchers through this process. So what this means is that all the researchers that are interested in performing these clinical trials are going to submit their research proposals. And then a panel of experts is assembled, and they go through a peer review process where they evaluate the different proposals and pick what they think is the best group that's best able to carry out the research in a responsible and meaningful way. So they have to submit all those sort of numbers and logistics, including the size of the study, staff required, time required, materials required, logistics, ethics, procedure, and basically have a very well-designed study, because it's that point of the scientific process that's really determining how much you can get out of the results of the study. Obviously, we all know if you don't have a proper control, you can't interpret your results, and that's a problem that a lot of these treatments and procedures run into. So they're really going to try and pick the very best group or groups to perform these clinical trials.
So where will these studies take place? Like, is it all going to be localized in a specific lab, or are we going to have labs in Vancouver and Toronto and Montreal and wherever doing their own experiments? Or
so this type of the clinical trials part, this will actually be human trials. So it'll actually take place in hospitals. I'm guessing sometimes they're delocalized and sometimes they are localized. So it depends on the design of the study. It could be happening sort of by one surgical team at one hospital where people are flown in from different places, or it could be a study where different people are actually performing the procedure and then the results are coming in. But some really important aspects of this are going to be things like patient selection, to make sure that you're getting an adequate sampling of those that suffer with MS and you're not actually treating a condition that's often connected with it, but not actually the disease itself. There's a lot of factors to really make sure that we are treating the condition with this procedure. So there's the two sort of cause and effect relationships that really need to be demonstrated by this study. And some of the preliminary work that I was discussing that has now come out is proving the causal relationship between the narrowed veins causing MS. That relationship needs to be shown, as well as having the liberation procedure or Zamboni procedure performed and a relief of symptoms of MS.
Yeah, from what I understand, like one of the big questions is the whole idea of cause and effect. Like, does MS cause this apparent narrowing of veins?
Other way around.
Or is it the other way around?
Oh, yeah.
That's the other thing. Like, there isn't even a causal link established yet as to which came first.
It doesn't actually need to be either as well, because people that are susceptible to MS might also be susceptible to a narrowing of the veins. And so there might not be any causal relationship, but more just a correlative relationship between the two. And exactly right, those two things really need to be demonstrated.
And now I'm going to put you on the spot, because as our medical expert now, so correct me if I'm wrong, but if blood is not draining properly from one's head, why doesn't it swell up like a balloon? I know it sounds silly, but someone has to ask it.
Well, actually, increased pressure on the brain is one of the stresses that's proposed to be a problem with that. So you don't so much have a swelling, as bone doesn't swell so much, but you could actually have swelling of the cranial tissues.
Isn't it like an aneurysm then? I mean, not quite,
but
it's
a bleed.
Well, it's where your blood vessel blows up like a balloon.
Yeah.
Right. So again, if there's this pressure building up, and you said the arteries, right? We are talking about
veins.
Opening up the veins. Sorry, veins. Right. So if we're opening up the veins, that means we're talking about blood, which means blood is pooling in the brain. Which is the implication I'm getting here.
It might not be. Well, there's pooling, and then there's just sort of not a smooth sort of drainage of blood completely. So I think from what I've read, some of the major issues are accumulation of iron in the tissues, and specifically the blood vessels. So obviously you have a lot of iron in the hemoglobin. I'm not 100% sure how that would get out, but basically, yeah.
Magnetic therapy. Yeah, okay. No, that was a joke.
So no, most of the time, I mean, unless you have soft tissues, they don't tend to blow up. You just get increased pressure.
Well, we'll have to keep our eye on these trials to see where they lead.
I do think it's really encouraging that although the procedure was really introduced in a very radical, sensational way and caused a bit of a ruckus and all kinds of emotional reactions from people, understandably, who have MS, I think it's a good idea, a really good sign that the government is going ahead with really good science-based logical research to be able to show that, you know, whether or not this procedure is beneficial, because there's no reason to not use it if it is beneficial just because someone jumped the gun.
And I think that's one of the themes that we've tried to reiterate, although sometimes better than the others, is we don't actually have an issue with things like traditional medicine or even alternative medicine of and of themselves, but they have to be scientifically tested and shown to become medicine. If they always remain in that alternative, in that traditional sense, then they've not actually ever been tested. They're not trying to meet the criteria that this treatment is attempting to achieve. So they're always going to be dubious, whereas this is trying to make that transition from dubious to respectable.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, we're going to stay respectable on here on Radio Free Thinker. Stay tuned after these commercial breaks.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
State of hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
We're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, tell us about assisted suicide.
Well, yeah, okay.
Such a light topic.
Something that Ethan keeps suggesting to me for some strange reason. I heard about a year ago that one of my favorite authors, Terry Pratchett of the Discworld series, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I also recently saw a documentary he made about his desire to die with dignity and the process he would have to go through to end his life on his terms. This got me to think about the idea of suicide, assisted end-of-life care, and the right to die. Now, this could be a huge topic, so first I thought I'd, you know, define some of the things that we're going to be talking about. First, there are usually three metrics in dealing with euthanasia. First is the difference between active and passive euthanasia. The active form is the stereotypical, but not exclusive, act of popping pills, being given an injection, using an object for asphyxiation, etc., all these requiring an individual or another to do something to bring about death. Passive euthanasia, as implied, is bringing about death by inaction, such as stopping feeding or hydration, not resuscitating, not providing medication, or simply turning off a life support machine. Another metric is voluntary versus involuntary. Obviously, voluntary is someone who agrees to have the procedure done, while involuntary is where an individual expressly refuses to give consent, like a capital punishment criminal, or incapacitated or unable to give consent in the sense of brain injury or similar incapacity. The last metric, and the one I think we might focus on a bit more here, is actually a subset of voluntary, and that's the difference between desired and coerced, with desired being a genuine desire for the individual to end their life, and coerced being a bit more complicated, meaning at first obviously being sort of forced into the decision that they may not actually wish to do, less more complicated is doing something they wish to do, but they may not wish to do now. This was one of the big issues that arose from the Terry Pratchett documentary, Choosing to Die. And the documentary itself focused on a nonprofit service in Switzerland called Dignitas that provides people with the means to choose death. But one of the huge issues in England, which makes a big thing in England and other parts of the world, is that if anyone helps you in doing this, they can be charged with crime. In Canada, for example, our law explicitly says that everyone who A, counsels a person to commit suicide, or B, aids or abets a person to commit suicide, whether suicide ensues or not, is guilty of an indictable offense, is liable to imprisonment for a term not to exceed 14 years. And one of the things that had come up with this, and it was deeply moving, this documentary in one sense, was you'd have like husband and wife, right? And, you know, one of them was diagnosed with a terminal illness, and it was something that at a certain point they would be incapacitated to actually end their life, even though their brain still may be functioning, but they lose control of their body. One of them had a Lou Gehrig's disease, where his nerves would just shut down, and at a certain point he would no longer be able to swallow or breathe, and he would die that way. But his brain would still be functioning well before this, but well before, long after his body ceased to actually function for him, and he would need assistance. And, you know, the wife could help, but if she did that, she'd be thrown in jail for helping with this. And Terry Pratchett himself was worried that at a certain point he would be deemed mentally incapable of making the decision, and for him to be in that state itself would be intolerable. And he knows that there's not like a switch that can go off where he's going to know that now's the day I got to do it, because tomorrow I'm not going to be here as far as I'm concerned. So that was one of the big things. And actually, this Dignitas brought up one of the really interesting argument I hadn't really heard before, was that they interpreted, or they asserted, that the European Charter of Rights has a clause in it based on the idea of the right of self-determination. And that, you know, this literally means that I have the right to determine when I live, when I die, and what happens with my body. And we accept this implicitly, often at least, when it comes to things like we talk about a woman's right to her body with regards to abortion, Jehovah's Witnesses' right to refuse life-saving procedures, or the impossibility of one person to own another, i.e. slavery, right? That we, as a culture, seem to accept that people do have an unequivocal right to their own body. Now, of course, this becomes complicated because sometimes, as we said, people need to be assisted to this. But again, in our society, if we have someone who's incapacitated and unable to do something for themselves, we don't seem to have a big issue that, you know, someone who does have the skill or the ability to do this. So if you're quadriplegic and you need help filling out your election forms like we had recently, sure, you know, you're allowed someone to help you assist in that, right?
Not only that, but often people are expected to. For example, the example you gave with the man and wife, if the, you know, maybe the husband was incapacitated and unable to sort of make this the actions necessary to commit suicide, the wife wouldn't be allowed to help him, but she sure has to keep feeding him, or else she's, you know, on the hook for neglect.
Well, exactly. Although, of course, ironically enough, well, in a hospital that isn't always the case, but that's the difference again between active and passive. So again, we sort of have this thing that, you know, if a person wants to do something, then society feels that if they're incapable of doing it through some form of incapacity, that if it's a right that they possess, we should try and do that. But all those rules seem to change when it comes to, again, the right to end one's own existence.
Such a final decision, you can't go back on it.
And actually, there's a number of laws out there that they're trying to bring in. The United States actually has a few sort of grassroots movement laws that are trying to address this, because there is a certain acknowledgement that, at least for terminally ill patients, which there seems to be very little issue about, that passive euthanasia is going on all the time in a lot of medical practitioners. In fact, a common term used on cancer wards is death by morphine, where doctors will allow patients to essentially OD on morphine in order to allow them to end their life in that way, right? Or, again, people can just say, I you know, I want you to no longer feed them or give them water and have people die that way. And that happens to a number of people in the United States, and it's not considered assisted suicide. It's because you're not actively doing anything. But I think the big thing these laws also make sure is that they try and draw out the process, because we do have a genuine respect for life. And one of the things that we're really worried about is that people will do things on sort of an impulse, right? That it's, you know, that they don't quote unquote have logical reasons to do this. You know, of course, the tried and true story of, you know, young love rejected, sees no point in continuing, or perhaps less romantically, someone who suffers from depression or has a temporary distress in their life, you know, they're bankrupt or something like that.
Or somebody gets in an accident, loses their legs, and they say, oh, screw it, I don't want to live anymore, type thing.
Exactly. So, I mean, to say that one has an absolute right, and some people do. Jack Kevorkian, which is someone who's big in this sort of right to die, actually often would promote that you had an absolute right to die, period. You didn't have to have any reason, no cause. If you wanted to do it, that was your right to do it, just like free speech is sort of a right in the States. But I think most of us do think that there should be at least some, not so much restrictions, but to sort of, again, draw it out to make sure that, you know, whatever these conditions are that are driving one to suicide are at least somewhat permanent or at least terminal.
It sort of seems actually like the mandatory waiting period to buy a gun. That's in place so you don't do that impulsively to cause harm to somebody else, but just on a longer time scale to really reflect the time that it actually takes to process the types of things that might cause you to want to end your own life.
Well, it sounds to me like what they could have in place is if a patient wanted to end their life, perhaps having some kind of advisory board say, okay, this patient has requested euthanasia, so we need to bring in a couple of psychiatrists, perhaps a couple of counselors, investigate this patient, make sure they're not being coerced, make sure that all medical procedures either have been exhausted or deemed too detrimental to the patient's quality of life,
well,
that sort of thing.
And actually, that's one of the things that this Dignitas process does. It's like there's actually about 3 or 4 visits you have to go through in order to do this, right? And they say they get a lot of people who go for the first visit, and a lot of people feel comforted to know that even if they're not going to do it, they have the option to do it, and that in a way provided them a lot of emotional relief to know that at least that was an option there. But you brought up the other big issue that comes in this, because you're right, if we draw out the process to a certain degree, we can kind of assure that it's not, like you say, it's not impulse suicide.
Yeah.
But the other thing is the idea of coercion. And actually, that was another thing that that comes up quite a bit, is that in a way you kind of want to make sure that the person's doing this for selfish reasons and they're not doing it, you know, for other ones. Because, I mean, there are a lot of other factors that will play into this. For example, the burden factor, where individuals may feel or be made to feel by society or their family that they're a burden, be it financially, emotionally, or physically, on their family. And they may feel the form of sort of peer pressure to end their life, not because they no longer wish to live, but because they wish to cease being a burden on their family.
Yeah.
Right? And ironically enough, you get this sort of a mirroring of this, but more dubious, I think, is economic factors, right? I mean, now, not so much family, but you get hospitals, right, which have limited resources. And quite often, if it's in some jurisdictions, you know, they don't want to have a patient in there who is on government support because, you know, end of life, quite often people have extinguish all their own financial resources and their own government assistance, and they want to free up the bed for quote-unquote paying customers, and that you kind of get this sort of incentive by the institutions themselves, sometimes genuine, by doctors who see genuine suffering, and sometimes less scrupulous, of people who just want to make some profit, who will sort of pressure the patient to say, you should end it now. You should end it. I know you think you should. And so you have this sort of idea of being coerced into it. And the last one, and again, now this brings us back to the documentary I was watching, is there's actually a certain degree of legal pressure. As I say before, the main focus of this was one gentleman who, when I saw him, he was well off. He had lots of money. It was him and his wife. And he was, again, he was no longer quite able to stand up on his own, right? And he was losing real control over his hands. But he felt like he had to do this procedure now, because if he didn't, he would need assistance later on. And that he was worried his wife would go to jail because he knew she would probably help him in the end. And he felt legal pressure almost to commit suicide now as opposed to waiting till later when he truly was gone in the head or he was really suffering in that way. And I don't know, it's a very complicated issue, and I think you're right. The idea of having a panel to set it up, you know, the making sure you draw out the process is important. We had here in our own cases, and now I can't remember her name, who was a quadriplegic, I think, or she was suffering from this. She couldn't do it herself, but Lou Rodriguez?
Doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. She sued to try and have, and I think the Supreme Court said no, she couldn't, and she ended up dying quietly on her own somewhere, and obviously someone had helped her with it, but it was wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Mm-hmm. You know, because that's the other aspect. If we kind of ignore the issue, it happens anyhow. Mm-hmm. If we can bring it out into the open and we can set up a certain amount of regulations, as Ethan had suggested, you know, a board to make sure that, you know, one, it's truly voluntary and desired, it is necessary, and there isn't some alternative to it. I don't know. I think is quite an important.
You know, when I was at the Secular Humanism Conference in Los Angeles last year or whatever it was, Ron Lindsay gave a very interesting talk about assisted suicide. And he mentioned doing a review of sort of the literature on it. And I think he was saying that there was very little evidence that coercion ever played a role in these sort of things. Usually it had to do with people either in extraordinary agonizing pain or people whose quality of life had degraded to such a level where they couldn't leave their hospital bed. And, you know, like, personally, like, when I think about it, I think it's, I would never want that. You know, like, I just think it'd be a bad idea. I mean, there's so much you can experience without moving your hands. But then again, I'm not in extraordinary agonizing pain. You know, I have no idea what my mental faculties will be like if every morning and every day I woke up in extraordinary pain and I couldn't even leave my bed. So, you know, just for my own emotional well-being, I would like to have the option of saying, okay, enough is enough. You know, I can't continue this. This is extraordinarily painful. So, I mean, it's a distressing thought because I don't think anybody wants to go and say, you know, oh yeah, everybody should just die when they want to, because I'm sure people will get depressed all the time. But when somebody's life has become so unpleasant and so miserable that, you know, that's their only option, I think that at that stage we need to have some sort of infrastructure in place to help these people deal with it.
Well, and there's also a certain degree of hypocrisy in our society, and I mean, maybe it's noble hypocrisy, but again, I mean, we have no problem, well, we seem to have no problem with letting people, you know, die from malnutrition, you know, in where, because we of a poor infrastructure in poverty, mm-hmm. or people who don't get appropriate or quick or assertive medical care or health care, right? I mean, you know, we're kind of focusing on assisted suicide here, but a number of people out there who will commit suicide, and not because they desire to, but because they weren't able to get into a psychiatrist or into a an institution to help them with any kind of issues like that, and mm-hmm. that we don't seem to be as concerned about, whereas here are people who, at least we're assuming we'll put certain safeguards, genuinely have a need or a reason to end their life. And we go, oh, no, we'll save everyone's life right up to the very last second, no matter how horrible it is, because we respect life. And it's...
Yeah, I mean, you can even look at, like, the military. And we have a problem with someone basically saying, you know, my life for the army or whatever. I mean, isn't it even written into the American Constitution something about the pursuit of happiness?
Yep.
I mean, if you can't pursue happiness, shouldn't there be some sort of clause that you can stop the pursuit or something? Or
secede from the Union?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to say it again, and I feel it's going to become a theme with me, but I think, again, people are scared of the sliding scale. It is really, really hard in legislation to draw lines, and that's what this type of legislation is requiring. So, as you were saying, Ethan, at this point in your life, it's really hard for you to imagine when that type of action might be really valuable to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of the people that are influencing policy are probably in the same boat, and are having, as you were saying, this sort of noble hypocrisy about what should and should not be protected without asking those who maybe have specific rights that they do want protected. And, you know, yeah, it's really, we can put these policies in place as far as how long it has to be drawn out, what kind of psychological evaluations. I personally think it's a really good idea not to have clinically depressed people making these decisions, as there's lower faculties for making that type of decision. But you can, it's hard to have a real safeguard where you can be sure. And I think that's what scares a lot of people. But as in all legislation, you do have to draw the line somewhere. And I think a societal fear of drawing that line can really be detrimental for the people that need it the most.
And actually, you know, again, something we've talked before about political skepticism is we do have actually the opportunity to do some empirical evidence. As I say, there are a number of places in the world where assisted suicide isn't deemed to be illegal. And I mean, they're far and few between. But you can start to see, well, what aspects of those laws and those conditions worked and what parts need to be fine-tuned, and you move on from there. I mean, life is an experiment, and yes, there may be occasions where you're going to get it horribly wrong, but there are also occasions where you'll learn from those mistakes and improve the system altogether. To draw back with our baby swing, you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
See, and I was just about to go there with, if you're allowed to swing a baby, why aren't you allowed to die?
Yeah. Well, that was a great discussion here on the show. We do encourage listeners to write in and share their thoughts on euthanasia.
One thing I should be very important to make out, because again, the law says it, we are in no way counseling any person to commit suicide. That would be against the law, and we are not doing that.
And against our own morals, I think.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we just kind of basically said that on this discussion. So, yeah absolutely. Email us at info@radiofreethinker.com. And, of course, swing by our website, www.radiofreethinker.com, for all our blog and show notes. Let's go into our skeptical highlights to wrap things up.
I have one that approaches pornography, so I'm ready. It's called Underwear Affair. Join BC Cancer Foundation's Underwear Affair and help uncover a cure for below-the-waist cancer, like prostate, ovarian, and caloric. It's not caloric. Deal with your bum.
Colonic? Colorectal.
Thank you. Colorectal. That's what I meant to say.
He has to have me say all his embarrassing words.
On July 9th this year, they are running to a competitive 10K run or a walk for 5K for fun, to show that there's no shame. All of them are going to be wearing underwear or something akin to that. As I say, the run starts at 6 p.m. It starts at the Seaforth Armory, and they go basically around False Creek. If you wish to donate, go to va11.uncoverthecure.org, and you can sign up there to sponsor somebody. We'll have a link on our show notes about that.
Excellent. My skeptical highlight is me, actually. I've written another blog post for Skeptic North, the pan-Canadian skeptical blog that brings together skeptic enthusiasts from BC to the Maritimes. And I've written a new piece called Climate Change, 400 Years Too Late for Henry Hudson, which is all about climate change in the Arctic and some of the consequences of that change. So check it out, skepticnorth.com. It's worth a read.
One of the things I thought funny, you mentioned that, I think it was Frobisher. They have a cabin of Frobisher that's up in the Arctic that's been perfectly preserved for like over 100 years now, but now it's in danger of decomposing because of global warming and all sorts of things that couldn't live up there now are being able to decompose the wood and that sort of thing.
Go evolution.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, Jenna, highlight?
I have a suggestion.
Okay.
Hug a scientist today, but don't cop a feel. That's creepy.
Well said. All right, then. This is Ethan.
Woo!
This is Ethan, your Freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on, and hands off.
This is Jenna saying remember, the real world is amazing.
All right, then. See you next week, folks.